If you want this podcast free of ads, follow us now on patreon.com/DavidMcWilliams.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you there? It's podcast time. John is with me. How are you, Ed?
I'm very good. Very good.
I just see you're coughing and spluttering like a smoker there. And the reason I'm saying that is not that I've been trying to make you give up, which I have been for the last 30 odd years, but I'm just back from Dubai. And you know what the strange things? Lots of strange things there. And we talked about it there the other day.
Yeah.
You can smoke in bars in Dubai.
Can you?
Yeah. And if you're a non-smoker, you come home smelling like
I know, it's awful, actually. It's awful.
Really awful.
Yeah.
It's really awful. No, so back from Dubai, I am. Do you know who's actually visiting me this weekend? Dan Ariely, my old mate, the behavioral economist. So we're going to have him on the podcast. He's all about behavioral economists, right? So what I'm going to ask him is, how do you get people to give up smokes, right? What behavioral little nudges do you have to come up with to give up fags? All right. What's the crack? I mean, what is on your mind?
Patches.
Yeah, exactly. What is on your mind?
What's on my mind? Well, I tell you, the thing that I'm hearing most about at the moment, everyone is banging on about, is inflation. And in particular, in the building trade.
Yes.
Now, we need to build the 40,000 houses or whatever it is per year.
Yeah.
But I was just looking at price increases in the building trade.
Okay.
For instance, softwood timber has increased by 47%.
In the last year. This is year on year.
This is since 2019 to 2021.
Okay. So over the last 2 years, it's a lot. Yeah.
Huge increase. Plywood, 55%. Copper, 62%. You know, for electricity, wiring of houses and all. Steel coil, 82%. Bricks, 16%. You know, it goes on and on and on. So what the hell is going on?
Okay, now what you've done, I'm going to give you an image. Do you ever go into a restaurant, John, right?
The odd time, yeah.
And you get a burger, right? And you think, ooh, I wouldn't mind more ketchup on that burger, right? And you're given a tube of ketchup, right, with a nozzle. Yeah. So think about this, right?
Yeah.
And you go and you squeeze it and you squeeze it and you squeeze it and then loads of it comes out,
yeah.
Right? Far too much, right? What's happening in the economy is exactly the same thing. So
I like this. Go on.
So that's a bottleneck. That's the image of a bottleneck, right?
Mm.
The pandemic was the weirdest thing. Now, we're going to go and talk to Dario Perkins, who's a real expert on this stuff, right, in a couple of minutes. But think about it. The pandemic does two things. First of all, it closes off demand straight away. Right? People were told, you cannot go out, stay in your house, don't buy anything, right?
Mm.
Or buy online, but you can't go out, right? First. Second thing is that means that supply goes through a massive shift. So loads and loads of factories and companies stop producing. So what happens is we forget that production is a fluid concept, right? Because it's based on this, remember this idea of the evolutionary economy?
Yeah.
So there's loads of different variables around. If you stop things suddenly, it's almost impossible to imagine restarting them seamlessly.
Mm.
So what is happening is you're having that ketchup moment, right? So
right,
all the ketchup is in the tube. It hasn't been open for a while. Coagulated. You know those horrible places, right? It's coagulated at the top.
Like it really, it's been like toothpaste tubes as well.
Exactly. So think about the toothpaste tube. That's a good example, right? Yeah. It's coagulated because obviously you don't brush your teeth that often, right? So it's coagulated at the top. So you squeeze and you squeeze. So you introduce demand straight away, which is John going to get his, to brush his teeth after a week's absence, okay?
Right? Jesus Christ.
And the thing, so you're squeezing it and you want the tube of toothpaste to deliver the toothpaste in a perfectly symmetrical,
of course,
non-inflationary way. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Just with lovely tapered ends.
Like a Colgate ad with a tapered end, you know, right? Okay. But in actual fact, it goes, right? Yeah. And it all comes out in one big thing, right?
And blocks the sink.
So that is exactly, so that's inflation, right? So basically what you're seeing is in all those lumber and bricks and where are the other inflation you were seeing?
The copper and steel, everything. So basically
all production was stopped. Then it's rekindled. And what is happening is the price is going up because there's all these supply bottlenecks because people aren't back to work, right? Which is the same reason why you have these shortages now, truck drivers, because again, what you can't do is say to all these fellas, oh, you've no work for 18 months. And then the minute demand comes back in, call them up and expect them to be there straight away because they're doing other things.
Yeah.
They've gone up, they may be actually doing up their house, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They may be doing other things. So look at inflation. So there's a difference between aggregate inflation, which is the rate of inflation across all the variables, right? Which is the rate of inflation that actually is the best aggregate snapshot of the economy. And then you have what I call these market-driven problems in various different sectors. So yes, it looks really bad in certain sectors, but on average, inflation is not rising. But the problem is, and it's a difference, we're going to talk to Dari about this, is everybody has their own inflation. Like my inflation is worse than your inflation, right?
Yeah.
So if you are, for example, 25 years old, in education, looking to rent, your inflation is unbelievably expensive, right? Because the price of education has gone up quite dramatically and the price of property. But if you are a 65-year-old who is in their own house, who is not spending a huge amount on things like for education, then your inflation could be very low. And so the question is, everybody's inflation is different. And that's, I suppose, what I would say to assuage your fears about this.
But so what you're saying is that it's a temporary measure.
Yeah,
I think so. And therefore, the central bank shouldn't be jumping in to raise interest rates straight away.
If the problem is a bottleneck in the soft furnishings sector of the economy, raising interest rates ain't going to help that.
Yeah.
That's the whole idea. So the central bank...
But there are so many bottlenecks at the moment. Like there's in the building trade is just the examples I gave there, but also in the microchip market that affects phones and cars and computers, the whole tech industry.
But what I'm saying is that look at the economy as something that operates over a long period of time and wait until these anomalies kind of clear themselves out. And if we're in the same position in 2 years' time, then we've got something to worry about.
Right.
But I think because the pandemic has been so weird, you know, the interesting thing is people talk about the recession. There was no recession in the pandemic. What there was a shutdown, right? And they said, there's no real recovery because it's not as if the economy was actually in recession and we're going to do recovery. The economy was put to sleep and people were being paid and now we've got to go back and spend. So I think we shouldn't underestimate how weird these times are. And therefore, to reimpose the economics of normal times on the economics of abnormal times will probably end to the wrong conclusion and doing the wrong thing. But I think what we should do is let's go over to Dario Perkins in London, a guy who's talking about this all the time, who's got an amazingly interesting take on it, and who's kind of one of the good guys. So let's go over and talk to him. Dario, how are you, man? I haven't seen you for a while. All good?
Yeah, not bad. Not had much of a summer over here, but I did get a week in Portugal, which was quite nice.
Yeah, and did you bring COVID back to everybody or just the family?
No, I took it over there.
Of course you did.
Yeah.
Huge part of the whole COVID thing, when I say thing, was a profound change in the way in which we did economics. Profound, profound change. And one of those changes was basically the assumption that inflation was something we didn't have to worry about and we could actually open the spigots, we could do some MMT, we could figure out all sorts of things because we didn't have to worry about inflation. You, on the other hand, are dealing with investors every day. and they've been worried about inflation for quite some time. Where are we at with that discussion?
Well, the thing is, I don't think they're really worried about inflation. They just want to talk about inflation. So actually, I'm providing some kind of counselling service for investors. I mean, you know, it's really been the only thing that people have wanted to talk about for the last 6 months. And, you know, the big issue is we've had this big pickup in inflation. Is that transitory, as central banks say, or is it the start of some kind of regime shift? Some, you know, are we headed back to the 1970s? And the thing is, even though every investor wants to talk about this, and it's the only thing that they want to talk about, they're all really relaxed about it. I mean, they totally buy in to this view that it's transitory. So it's really a case of people identifying this as a risk, but it doesn't seem to be something that people are genuinely concerned about.
So, Dario, can you explain the transitory idea, this idea that you come out of something as odd as a pandemic, your supply lines are all screwed, your relationships are cut, people are not at work, people are on the PPE here, the sort of the government payout. So the economy isn't working as it should be. And therefore, yeah, it's not that unusual that you might get inflation in certain areas, and it's not that unusual to be transitory. Can you explain the whole process to me?
Yeah, so the idea is that we get this burst of inflation, but then without central banks doing anything, without there being any policy tightening, inflation just comes back down by itself. And actually, if central banks were to try to react to the inflation numbers they're seeing right now, because there are lags in the system, by the time those policies had an effect, inflation would have already come down. So they'd just make the situation worse. And I guess the best kind of historical parallel is what happened after the Second World War, because we had this kind of huge pent-up demand in the US and the UK. You had rationing, you had severe supply shortages, you had issues with, you know, trying to reintegrate soldiers back into the workforce. So supply was massively constrained, demand was coming back very strongly, and you got this big shift in the price level. But then inflation came down quite quickly without a policy response, because it would have been unpatriotic to raise interest rates in that kind of environment. And I think that's kind of the template that these policymakers have in mind. And, you know, the big contrast is what happened after the First World War, because we had the same kind of trends after the First World War. But in the UK, we tried to get back to the gold standard. So we did try to force prices lower again. And of course, that ended up giving us a decade of mass unemployment and deflation. So I think this is absolutely the right way to behave coming out of this pandemic.
So this is fascinating. So basically what you're saying is we have a choice. The 2020s can either be like the 1920s, which is massive deflation, total and utter collapse of political stability in the center in continental Europe. You can do that in order to get back to the gold standard and some sort of conception, as Keynes described, the barbarous relic, right? Or we can have the 1950s, which is unparalleled growth in Europe, unparalleled growth even in the UK, which was kind of limping, and the United States going through arguably its most splendiferous economic decade on record in terms of the massive uplift. And is that the sort of policy that's which one do you want?
I think that's the right way to think about it. And I think, you know, the basic point here is that we can't really do anything about the price increases that we're seeing. I mean, and this comes down.
Now explain that to me.
Yeah. So if you think about where's the inflation coming from? So it's very concentrated in a few items that have gone up in price very quickly. Part of this is just, you know, think about what COVID did. I mean, it caused global demand and supply to collapse. And we had this, and demand probably fell faster than supply. So we had this deflationary fear this time last year. You know, bond markets were pricing in this massive deflationary skew. Everybody was worried about what central banks were going to do next. You know, were we going to have to go down helicopter money and all of that stuff? And then as we've tried to come out of COVID, both demand and supply have recovered. But demand has picked up much more quickly than supply. So we're getting this very intense supply disruption and bottlenecks and shortages. And you see this all over the world. I mean, you know, global shipping is in a complete mess. You have scarcity of, you know, all kinds of commodities. We have problems in semiconductors. We have all these logistical problems. And we know that, you know, when there are big shifts in activity, you always get these kinds of pressures. I mean, this is what's called the bullwhip effect, which is that if you have a relatively small change in demand, it causes these big kind of accumulation of pressures down the supply chain. And of course, what we're talking about here is the biggest contraction and expansion in global growth in 300 years. So yes, this is causing very profound problems through supply chains. But it isn't clear that raising interest rates is the way to deal with that problem. You just have to kind of let this work its way out of the system again. And if you were to try to deal with that by tightening policy, I think you'd make the situation a lot worse.
No, I mean, it seems to me that what we're dealing with, as you say, it's just this is a unique situation. And always, you know, time does, I know it sounds trite and cliched, but time does sort a lot of things out. You know, things do unravel and then things get put back together again. So what you're saying is don't be so freaked out that new car or used car sales or used car prices in America are going through the roof, or don't be so freaked out by the price of lumber, or don't be so freaked out by the supply chain disruption over to Asia, because again, things have been moribund for a year and a half, and that's kind of what happens. You need, the engine needs to slowly get back up to speed. That's what we're kind of talking about.
Yeah, you have the base effects, which I know you did a podcast on a few months ago, which is that prices that were falling this time last year are rising now. So that immediately translates into a big increase in inflation. You have supply disruptions in things like semiconductors, car rentals, used cars, lumber, you know, all of the things that you outlined, semiconductors, shipping, all of that stuff. You have, you know, tomatoes rotting in fields in Italy because they can't get steel from China to export passata, which is a big concern for me, obviously.
As being a half Italian, absolutely. A man, Italians, the Italian, remember, it was Napoleon said that obviously the army marches on its stomach, but every time you go to Italy, you realize that the nation simply lives and dies by every lunch it consumes.
And, you know, food rage is a real thing in Italy. I mean, you see how upset they get on Twitter when, you know, the English tried to make carbonara and things like that. So it's a big political issue. And then you have, you know, a whole bunch of kind of one-off cost increases. So you think about, you know, coming out of this pandemic, you've got all these companies operating under reduced capacity, new health and safety regulations, things like, you know, the price of haircuts, which doesn't affect me because obviously I don't have any hair. You know, that stuff is going through the roof. That's a one-off price increase, a cost increase that companies are trying to pass on. But I think, you know, these kinds of dynamics will settle down eventually. I mean, we don't know, you know, how quickly we're going to come out of this pandemic. We still have new variants. We still have new problems. These issues could persist for a while. But I don't, you know, I don't think this is the start of some big wage price spiral. And actually, you even have these kinds of supply bottlenecks in labor markets because, you know, a lot of people are struggling to go back to work. They can't get the childcare, or they haven't been able to get the childcare until the schools have reopened. They're still concerned about COVID, particularly if they work in particular industries, particular sectors. So there's even shortages of workers. And I've talked before about how inflation is ultimately about power. And if you want to get, you know, serious inflation, you have to have pricing power. You have to have worker power. You have to be in a situation where workers can demand big wage increases, and then companies can pass that on. And that's what happened in the 1970s. But we're so, you know, far detached from what happened in the 1970s. There's little pockets of worker power because, you know, the fact that these workers can't come back into work, you're seeing companies having to raise wages. But again, most of that looks like a kind of bottleneck or a temporary factor. I think there is a story about whether the longer term inflation outlook is changing. And that's about whether we're going to get different type of power dynamics eventually coming out of this crisis. So this is what we talked about a few months ago, the new kind of super cycle and MMT. And
Let's explore that a bit, because that's fascinating to put it kind of a big super cycle framework. And once you have a framework, then the world makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah. So this is the idea that we've had these kind of big 30, 40 year super cycles in the global economy, kind of macro, finance, politics. And the last one, you know, started in the late 70s when we'd had a massive inflation problem and, you know, inflation was dominating everything. And then we had Reaganomics and Thatcherism, and it came in and it crushed worker power and it crushed the unions and it globalized markets and it opened up finance. And then we were in this kind of of 30-40 year super cycle of low inflation, neoliberalism. And it was, you know, eventually it led to massive inequality, asset price bubbles, you know, all of the bad stuff that we've had over the last decade. And I think we're starting to see the first challenge to that. So, you know, this kind of neoliberal regime seems to be starting to come to an end. And obviously Bidenomics in the US is a big attack [S2] Yes. [S1] On that. But I think we're at the very beginning of that process. And I think you can look at the world and say something is changing here. And maybe eventually we'll get back to something, you know, a bit more like the world that we had after the Second World War, you know, one in which workers are a bit more empowered and they can push for wages and companies can push for price increases. But I think we're a long way from that. And I think, you know, the big kind of inflationistas, if you want to call them that, those guys that are out there talking about inflation is here and it's coming back.
And there's quite a few of them. There's quite a few of them.
There are a few. And I think they're confusing those two stories. They're confusing what we're seeing in the data right now, which is, you know, massively transitory. It's all about COVID. I mean, you can just see the COVID imprint on the data. And this longer term story about how the world might be changing. And I think, you know, they're putting those two stories together. And I think they're very different and they could be separated by, you know, big time span. I mean, we could be talking decades before we start to worry about, you know, central banks that aren't independent and governments that are doing too much in terms of stimulating their economy. You know, I don't think those two stories overlap. And I think that's causing an enormous amount of confusion in financial markets.
Yes, it's also not just in financial markets. I see it with, for example, our own government introduced the other day a big, big initiative on housing, because we've got to build a lot of houses here. By my own kind of back of the envelope calculations, we'd need to do about 45,000 per annum, okay, units, houses, apartments, whatever. The government said came out with, you know, a figure of 33,000, right? Now, half of my sense of them being nervous is that the mandarins who still work in the Department of Finance here are inflationistas, right? They're kind of saying, look, we're on the cusp of something. We need to fix it, but we can't fix it as much as you'd like to, because you know what? Inflation's around the corner. So it's not just financial markets. I think policymakers are also in that sort of frame of mind where they're not too sure to back their own judgment. And again, unfortunately, in economics, a lot of the people still making the major decisions, they were children of the late 70s. So they have an inflation thing in their heads. Would you go along with that?
I think that's true. I mean, you see that. I mean, the investors who are most concerned about inflation are the ones that remember the 1970s. You can look at consumer surveys of inflation expectations. You know, it's the older demographics who are so concerned. You know, if you're, you know, in your 20s or 30s, it seems completely bizarre to worry about this world that, you know, they haven't lived in before. And that's just a bias. You know, this is a bias in the way that people perceive inflation. And I think, you know, that's a big story. When we survey people, we see that inflation expectations are heavily distorted by people's own experience of inflation and also by the stuff that they buy most frequently. So, you know, if oil prices are going up quickly, if grocery prices are going up quickly, that tends to have a big effect on people's expectations of inflation, just because it's the stuff that they see going up in price all the time. I mean, I used to get this at the Treasury. So one of my first jobs at the UK Treasury was to do briefing on inflation for government ministers. And every week we got these letters saying, why are you lying to the public? You know, you say that inflation is 2%, but this week I bought a can of baked beans and it was 72p. And last week it was 50p. How on earth is that 2% inflation? You know, so we get these big kind of psychological biases and you know, that affects the way that people perceive inflation. But I think, you know, a lot of this is just a myth. You know, I think it would be very difficult to go back to the 1970s. I don't think that policymakers could recreate that climate, even if they tried really hard.
But you can also, Dario, understand, for example, you talked about the 20s and 30s, that big, big generation who are being screwed in the housing market, on the rental market. And when they hear, you know, economists coming on and say, well, actually, inflation is at an all-time low. It's a, you know, 1% or 2% or something. They're saying, hold on a second. My inflation, it's, you know, it could be that idea. I think there was something at the beginning of the 2008 crisis, somebody was talking about the recession and somebody said, well, it's not your recession, it's my recession. So to what extent is my inflation more important than inflation as an indicator or as a concept or as a feeling?
Well, I mean, you know, as I said, I think everyone has a distorted idea about where inflation is. I mean, you know, these inflation measures, I mean, they're really the best, they're the best macro data we have because, you know, they're quite easy to collect. You send people out to shops and they collect the data and they measure and they do it for a huge number of items, you know, a huge variety of goods and services. And, you know, as far as economic data go, they're probably the best indicators we have. But, you know, stuff like housing isn't always included in those measures.
So if you're listening to this podcast, you and I are trained economists. We say, oh, you know, with house prices aren't in inflation because it's a cost. So we look towards rents, whatever. The average person thinks, I hear, why not? Like we've just assumed it away. But
that's the reason, you know, the history of this is that housing is an investment and that's not what we're supposed to be measuring. We're supposed to be measuring consumer goods. In reality, inflation measures are a bit of a mess because you have kind of semi-durable stuff. You have things like washing machines. You know, my wife buys a new coat. She tells me that's an investment.
It is an investment. She's absolutely right.
Ultimately, I think that you have to think about it in practical terms and what is it that central banks are trying to deal with? And I think their argument is that when you put things like housing in, then you may as well put things like equity markets in. And then these indicators are going to become very, very volatile. And they don't want that type of volatility. They want to get a sense of how much demand there is in the economy. And you know, trying to use interest rates to slow demand when it's becoming excessive and ease, you know, when demand is too weak. So I still think you have to look at those types of things because, you know, obviously we had the subprime crisis, we had the housing bubbles. You can't have policymakers just ignoring these things. But I think they believe that there are better tools for dealing with those kinds of risks than just raising up interest rates and trying to squeeze the economy.
Now, just before you go, COVID, right? When you're talking to investors now, is there a sense that some of them are kind of thinking, is this thing ever going to go away? Because had we talked in June, we'd have been pretty sanguine. We were all getting vaccinated. You guys were all vaccinated. The Delta hadn't reemerged. It hadn't arrived. And there was a sense of, you know, this thing's going to just peter out over the course of the next while with a combination of vaccines in particular. What's your sense now of where COVID is and where the economy is with COVID?
Most investors have not really thought about COVID for the past 12 months. You know, when it struck, you had this big collapse in global stock markets and you had, you know, all kinds of a real danger of a financial crisis, you know, this kind of feedback loop between financial markets and the real economy. And central banks, you know, stopped that. They kind of halted that process in its tracks. And then it's been quite hard to get investors to think about COVID ever since then, rightly or wrongly. Now, I think you're right that there's been this perception that we're always about to exit this crisis. You know, you go when it started, it was supposed to be a three-month problem. It was supposed to be SARS, you know, a one-quarter effect on GDP. And then we got, well, you know, it will disappear, you know, during the summer. This was last year. We got to the autumn and suddenly we've got a new wave. And then, you know, by the end of the kind of winter, you had the vaccines and then you had this perception that, okay, well, now it has to go because we've got the vaccines and that's the silver bullet that's going to get us out of this. And then we've had this other wave. Now, I think, you know, the thing that I think investors draw some assurances from is what's happened in the UK over this latest wave. So we got Delta, you know, before most other, you know, European countries, before the US. And, you know, this wave has looked very, very different to the previous waves. You know, we've had huge numbers of people catching COVID, but the health impact has been, you know, radically different. We haven't had the pressure on hospitals. And really, from a policy point of view, that's what they care about most. You know, we can't be in a situation where the NHS is being overrun and there's ambulances queuing outside hospitals and people can't get the healthcare. So I think now, you know, they've been treating this a bit more like something like swine flu. You know, it's a nasty illness. You don't want to get it, but it doesn't mean you have to lock down, shut everything down. And, you know, on the basis of what's happened in the UK over the last 6 months, that's still pretty much holds. The question, you know, is going to be if we start to get new variants of this and they do start to dodge the vaccines, you know, we're going to need booster shots. And, you know, there is a risk, I guess, that the policy is always slightly behind the virus. So, yes, you can change the vaccines, you can have booster shots, but we're always slightly behind, and the health services are always slightly close to the brink. So then you need more restrictions. And I do, you know, it is just over the last few weeks that the discussion with investors has started to change a little bit. And I'm starting to get this question, well, is it ever going to go away? And if it doesn't, you know, what will the world look like? So this is the idea.
What do you say to them?
Well, you know, again, it's the Perkins Counseling Service.
Yeah, it's sort of kind of a shrink for rich people.
You know, I tried to take some comfort from what's happened in the UK and the fact that it has looked very different. I guess, you know, we just have a lot more disruption, that, you know, we'd have kind of more stop-start growth, that the cycle never really gets going. And I think in that world, you know, the supply disruption probably continues. I don't think that gets you into this world of kind of rampant 1970s inflation. But we could be in a world where inflation becomes much more volatile. You know, it suddenly peaks, it comes down very sharply, it then rebounds again. That would be quite different to the world that we've been in. Because when you look at the kind of long history of inflation, you had these peaks, you know, after the First World War, peak after the Second World War. Every time there's an energy crisis or an increase in oil prices or whatever, the inflation rate peaks, then it comes down quite quickly again. It's really only the 1970s where you had this trend increase in inflation that lasted about 15 years, and then a trend decline in inflation that lasted, you know, another 20 years. But maybe we're in a world now where you don't have the trend increase or the trend decline, you just have volatility. And I think that's going to be quite hard for investors and policymakers to deal with. And, you know, the question for central banks is really going to be, if inflation is more volatile and maybe settles slightly above their targets, what do they do? And I think, you know, the best case here is what happened after the global financial crisis in the UK. You know, we can talk about the First World War, we can talk about the Second World War, but we do have this period of transitory inflation after the global financial crisis, which is when you know, sterling tanked, you had big increases in oil prices, you had fat hikes in the UK. UK inflation hit 5% and it stayed there. You know, it stayed well above target for about 2.5 years. The Bank of England had to write letters every month explaining why it was missing its target. You know, I was at the receiving end of those letters at the Treasury. You know, Mervyn King desperately trying to explain what was going on and you know, making excuses. But the bank basically ignored it. You know, it looked through it and it said, well, when we look at the state of our economy, we can see that unemployment is high. We can see the economy is weak. And so, yes, inflation is temporarily high, but we think it's going to come down again. And we need to focus on the longer term, because that's our contribution to policy. And so maybe, you know, that's the template for this time around, that central banks will ignore it. It will be volatile. Maybe it will be a bit above their targets for a while, but they won't react to it. The difficulty is whether they can really hold their nerve. You know, there's only so long that these policymakers can keep saying it's transitory, it's transitory, it's transitory. And if, you know, two and a half years down the line, we're still getting all of these distortions and we're still in a mess with the supply side, then, you know, can they keep using that T word?
Well, let's hope for a little bit of wisdom, because I think wisdom is in short supply here. You know, the idea... But it's the confidence to see beyond things, you know, confidence to see beyond the next quarterly data. And I hope they hold their nerve, because I think if you jack up interest rates now, even slightly, it changes the ballgame completely, because I don't think we're out of this thing by any stretch of the imagination.
You know, this pressure that they're under isn't helpful. I mean, you know, people in financial markets, these kind of inflationistas, piling the pressure on these central banks, it isn't helpful. And your mate Andy Haldane is part of this, because I don't know if you read his...
Oh, I saw that. Yeah. You know, his shot was...
Shot of the Bank of England. But I mean, that was, you know, if you're an insider at the Bank of England, that's pretty shocking. I mean, he basically said that he was becoming more and more uncomfortable with central banking and what was happening in central bank. They were losing their independence, that we were facing a Minsky moment for central banking. Now, that's... really piles the pressure.
Yeah, no, it does. It does.
Saying we're going to repeat the 1970s is pretty much the worst thing you
can possibly say. No, it's true.
You know, the whole institutions have been informed by the 1970s. The 1970s is what gave them their independence. It's what changed monetary policy permanently. And so any risk of going back to that, you know, they have to take that seriously, unfortunately.
I'm just thinking Andy Haldane as Bond vigilante, as intellectual vigilante in the thing. Dario, we'll leave it there. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. And we will talk to you soon.
All right. Take care.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Who knew that inflation could be so interesting?
You love it. You love it, don't you?
I do. I do, actually. But you know what? While Dario was talking there, it really reminded me of Neil Howe. Do you remember we had Neil Howe on before? He's the guy who wrote that book, The Fourth Turning.
Yes. Great, great thinker. Proper. Interesting.
You know, when you were talking about in terms of decades and long time frames.
Yes.
That's what Neil Howe spoke about in terms of, he was kind of saying that the decade that you are born into kind of defines your worldview.
Yes, and I think it does. And also what's also interesting, if you take the Howean view, we'll give him a Howean. is the notion also, not only that the decade is important, but that my inflation is as important as your inflation.
Yes.
So it's the same idea. So everybody's personal experience with anything defines our perception of everything. So if you think, for example, if you ever meet people whose parents went bankrupt, they have a very different relationship with money
to
people whose parents did not go bankrupt. So your relationship with money is a function of many things, one of which is your experience with money. And your
I have to say, just on that note, I have a pathological fear of being in debt. And that was because when I moved to London first, I fell into huge debt. And the stress of it was enormous. But as a result of that, I have a, you know, complete fear of being in
debt. That's interesting. No, and I think lots of people listening will have had the same experience, particularly here in at the end of the Celtic Tiger and that period between 2007, 2006, 2007, 2008 and 2015 of negative equity, of debt, of bailiffs, of sheriffs coming, of not being able to not just pay the rent, but not being able to see any way out of it. And I happen to think that if we're talking about debt, I happen to think that the Bible is very interested in this, John. So in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, these are books that I read late at night. Okay. No, there's a big part of biblical thinking on debt forgiveness that basically that you cannot expect your neighbor to be a good neighbor if you have them consistently in debt, right? And so the Bible and the people who wrote the Bible, just think about the wise men who wrote the Bible, they were very explicit that we have to have debt forgiveness at certain periods, and it was called in the Bible the Jubilee year. So it was meant to be once every 7 years you settle debts and you negotiate them. And I think it's extraordinarily important because debt destroys people. There's actually a great book by a guy called David Graeber, who passed away last year, called Debt, A 5,000-Year History. And so it starts really way back. And Graeber was an American anarchist, an anthropologist, first of all, but an anarchist anthropologist, very fascinating guy. But his main thesis is that debt is the most debilitating, most obnoxious, and most insufferable position that anybody can be in. Bondage, debt, slavery, all those sort of things. So, you know, and you experienced it in London a little bit, but lots of people experience it all their lives.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly stressful. Incredibly stressful.
But in terms of this whole idea of my inflation.
Yes.
And the official inflation figures.
Yeah.
How accurate then? Well, you know, when they produce inflation figures, like, they're not really accurate because they don't really apply. They're just a big generalization.
Well, that's statistics for you, you know? That basically statistics is very unusual. Statistics is hyper-objective. So a statistician has to be hyper-objective. But we are all subjective.
Mm.
So you see a thing like the rate of inflation is 2%. And you say, well, my rate of inflation is not 2%. My rate of inflation is 20%.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you look at the things that inflation, the things that have been runaway inflation in the last few years are healthcare, education, and rents.
Okay. Yeah.
Those three things that where inflation has been falling profoundly is mobile phones, technology, laptops, etc. But if you are in education and you're paying for private education, right, or you're paying for education in third or fourth level here, and you're renting, the rate of inflation that you face every week, every month is much higher than the rate of inflation of, say, for example, a homeowner who's 65 or 70 who changes phone every couple of months, right? Or who flies Ryanair.
Yeah.
Right? So what I find fascinating, we'll kind of conclude on this, is that my rate of inflation is actually what causes social unrest, not the general rate of inflation. So to go back to the Neil Howe idea is that your personal experience with anything dictates how you feel. So if you are young in Ireland or anywhere in the world, the rate of inflation that is most opposite to you is rents or house prices. And it doesn't matter to you if actual fact the rate of inflation in oil prices is low because you don't have a car.
Exactly, yeah.
So there was a problem then, is how do you subjectify the objective, right? So the objective is the general rate of inflation, which is what it is. But the fact that most people don't feel it, and those who don't feel it don't worry about it, but those who feel it, those who feel that this is wrong, worry excessively about it, is actually the source of class war, generational war, and the nitty-gritty of politics that, John, we are seeing playing out in this country, but all over the world, because the people who are affected by a high rate of inflation don't believe any more official statistics. And once you don't believe official statistics, then you stop believing anything from officialdom.
Mm.
And then you become the skeptical nation, skeptical country. And that, as you and I have talked about over the last couple of years, pushes you very close to listening to the people who say, don't worry about this, I have a solution. Make America great again, take back control, all that sort of stuff. So it is dangerous. Economics, when not explained properly, I think is one of the most dangerous things in the world. I'd like to thank all our Patreon supporters, because without you, this wouldn't be possible. So thank you all very, very much. And we have a little treat for you coming up. We have a new online course. We have a new entire podcast monetary economics course. I mean, monetary economics at the moment is so important. And we have a fantastic course. We're just finishing it. It's going to be with you probably end September, John, or 1st of October?
I would say mid-October.
Mid-October. So you're, look, you flirt with me, you tell me it's going to go ahead, then you say, it's not you, it's me. What's the story? Mid-October.
I've got to edit out all your shots.
All right, there you go. Talk to you later. And again, thanks so much for supporting us.